My name is Ellen, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." Tonight, I am super excited to introduce Susan F. from the Rush Hour group, and she must be really important because she has a whole group of people and family behind her. So welcome.
All right. I cannot believe I'm doing this. All right. My name is Susan, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for all of the network that has grown up around me that has shown up tonight, because that's pretty amazing. All right. So I'm very nervous, just so you know. Okay. So I was born in Atlanta in Piedmont Hospital. And I went to E. Rivers, and then I went to Sutton Middle School. And my mother was an alcoholic, and my father traveled. So she was one of those kind of alcoholics that couldn't function. And so she would be, you know, out. And so I can remember doing laundry at 6, trying to figure out what it says on the washing machine, and figuring out how to do TV dinners at 7, you know, which was too young, I realized, for my daughter. But, so anyway, and so then when I was 11 or 12, she stopped drinking, or she quit, I would say, because she had Anabuse and Valium. And so I didn't know about the Valium until years later, but in my 11 or 12-year-old mind, she said to us, "Oh, I love your brother and you so much, and I just couldn't do this to you anymore. And so here, watch me take this pill." And while Dad's out of town, and she was able to quit. And we started going to church. My dad told me at 6 years old that God didn't exist, so I was a little confused there. So around the time my mom stopped, I started drinking. And I remember the first time I got drunk, my parents were kind of strict, and all my friends, like in 7th, 8th grade, were having a party, and they were going to be doing 7th Heaven and all the cool things, and I couldn't go. So I got drunk at home, and I drank a little bit out of every bottle in the liquor cabinet, you know, and I chased it with Tab, and I got so sick. I got so sick, and I was spinning and throwing up, and my brother came, and he's giving me peanut butter and trying to get me to eat, and you know, and my mother came to the door. They had company downstairs. She came to the door at one point to check on me. And I sprayed Wind Song in my mouth. And to this day, y'all, if you had never smelled Wind Song, to me, it is synonymous with throw up. I mean, it was very popular perfume. And it was, ugh. So, I continued to drink, and my drinking career started with hiding it and sneaking it and doing it to get relief. But I didn't remember that until I came this time, because I'd lied about all that. So I got caught shoplifting when I was like 16, and my parents searched my room. They found liquor bottles, and so the gig was up. And I always looked back on this time thinking that I tried to commit suicide because of all these other reasons. After I'd been a while in AA, I got 5 years, by the way, but I realized that I tried to commit suicide because I realized the alcohol was going to be taken away and I couldn't live without the alcohol. And I didn't have any other coping skills, you know, and this was in the 80s when they were putting all the kids in treatment centers. And so, but my insurance wouldn't pay for the A and drug, the A and D unit, alcohol and drug unit for teenagers. So, which is what I needed, but it would pay for depression. So they put me in the psych ward. And, I was there for 5 months. That's my magic number, y'all. 5 months, I was there. And I was so good, and I followed all the rules, and I was the first level four they'd had in years. And I met my boyfriend, and he was an alcoholic too. And, oh, it was wonderful. And so I got out of there, and my parents started going through a divorce, which was a great thing for someone who wants to be drinking and fucking around and messing around behind everybody's back and not being caught. And so so I used that to my advantage. I went to college, got pregnant, left college, married my little high school sweetheart, and immediately got pregnant. Okay, so did I say that? And then started working at Ken's Tavern because that's where a good alcoholic needs to work. My story includes doing drinking and drugs while I was pregnant. And so that husband didn't work out, and we got a divorce, and I blamed all him. I did not think I was an alcoholic, really, at the time, because I had dinner on time every night. I had matching tablecloths for every, you know, season. I was being a good mother, and I was, you know, and he was the one, because he'd gone really bad. So that was one of my patterns, was to find someone that did things worse than I did. So I could, you know, I think can relate, some of you maybe. Anyway, so then I figured out after I left him that it was not sustainable to be the kind of drinker that I needed to be and be a single mom, because I didn't finish college and I don't have many skills. I did get a couple of good jobs during this time. One was at a law, well, both were at law firms, and both of them I got fired for drinking. What I needed at that point was a man to help me pay the bills and to co-sign my drinking. So the first one was Mike. We'll call him the good Mike. And I started going to treatment centers. And I needed detox at that point. But I started going to DAC. It was my first treatment center. I went there 3 times. Graduated once. I'm good at treatment because I can follow all the rules. And plus, I was on Antabuse. And so during that time, there's like 4 years here where I am, twice during that time I drank on Antabuse, so I might be an alcoholic. And, you know, the second time, it's like, what? And then my mother was really sick with Huntington's disease, which is like Alzheimer's and Lou Gehrig's and everything wrapped up together, and I was at risk for that disease. I was told that she drank because she was scared she had Huntington's. So, y'all, I got a built-in reason to drink. And so every time I go to treatment, they say, oh, you have a lot on your plate. You're a single mom. Your husband's a crackhead. Your ex-husband's a crackhead, you know, and you got a lot on your plate. I had, you know, it was a lot. So then at that point, it just was boyfriend to boyfriend to, my daughter was in 7th grade. I think it was, or 8th, was the last really expensive rehab my dad paid for. Now I'm having to go and get DT. I mean, now I'm drinking so much that I have to go to the detox center. So the crisis center, the first time I went, I was telling this story the other day, I took a curling iron and a hair dryer with me because I thought it was going to be like treatment, you know. And that was my first taste of DeKalb County jail food. But not my last. So then I, you know, I was going, now I'm, you know, I'm having to go through DTs. I remember the first time I went through DTs and I was like, I'm never going to drink again because this was awful, you know. And that just waking up and, you know, oh, my God. So I was like, you know, and I remember then many, 2 decades later, sitting in a meeting in my home group and this guy saying, I just came out of detox and I'm never going through that again. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I remember thinking that will not work. So I got jobs, you know, I had a couple of good jobs that were where I had insurance and I had, you know, I'm around people that are normal and they are single mothers and I made enough money to protect, you know, but I was, I needed to be in a job where I got money every day, like restaurant work, bartending, and, you know, a lot of waitressing. And so, because you can, it's very easy to be an alcoholic and wait tables. It's good hours for that. And also, they can't fire you for, I mean, you, they need, wait, the waitress, the waiting industry can't afford to have people that don't drink. Let's just be, you know. So, you know, there was a lot of things that I'm not supposed to talk about in the middle of all that story. And if you are in NA or have that story too, and you, after the meeting, I'll be glad to regale some horrible stories for you. But my the reason I was able to not let that kill me, and I went down really far, was because of alcohol, because I still had the alcohol. And I had defects, you know, down my throat. I would quit for defects. I would quit for my, if I'm losing everything and my dad will pay for me to go to rehab, I would quit for all those reasons. But once my daughter turned 18, I remember realizing at some point that year that I would probably never get sober because I won't have any reason to anymore. And because she was my, you know, reason, and be honest, defects and everything. And so I'm going to skip forward here, but it was several relationships, and to the boyfriend I found now, and it, and my pattern was to get in a really bad relationship, physically violent situations, and then jump to the next guy who was rescuing me, and all the while, we need to both drink the same, or at least, you know, they have to be at least worse, but the same will do, and it's nice if they have a car and a job, but this one did not have a car, and he was on other things, and I was on other things, and so we fell in love and went off into alcoholic, live happily ever after, and we are still together now, and so we're drinking, and we're not doing the other things, and we put them out of our life. You know, mainly we got this opportunity to get a house in Chamblee. That's the other thing, just to qualify myself. When they talk about lowering your standards, where we lived was lowered and lowered. And so we did a lot of the Hotel by the Weeks, which is a horrible place to live. And then after that we went, there's a place right up the street on Claremont from Biscayne. And it was an old lumber warehouse that was half the size maybe of this room, and it had six little apartments in there. Everybody's on different levels of needing a program, and which one of them was sober actually, and he was. But so we didn't have a kitchen, so I knew how to make a kitchen. You go to Goodwill and you get you an electric skillet and a toaster oven and a microwave, and you were set to go. And then we would boil water and wash the dishes, and I would wash our clothes. We didn't have money for, we had money for rent and alcohol and sometimes all the cigarettes we needed, but, you know, food was low. I was big on shoplifting, which I'm making amends for. I'm so grateful, but I was big on shoplifting food. I didn't, because I needed my money for alcohol. I got caught at Cub Foods one time, and I've got all these tall boys in my bag that I'm stealing with my three-year-old in the buggy with me, and I'm paying for the beer, and I got all this food shoved in my bag. And, you know, so I wasn't making good choices, but if I look back on my life and I think, well, I was protecting my drinking, I was doing a damn good job. And so my daughter graduates, and now I get into the boyfriend, you know, we were living a very bad life. And, oh, I mean, so now the good boyfriend, the one I'm with now, oh my God. So anyway, what happened was my liver went into failure. And so I was having encephalopathy, which meant that I couldn't think clearly. And so what I was doing before that, I was babysitting these children where my boyfriend works, where I've worked at an antique store in a prop house. And the little kids, I've been doing some data entry, and the little mom saw I was good with the kids. And so she hired me to work with the kids, and I could drink. I could drink. So everybody thought it was a water bottle. It wasn't water. And over the years, people would figure out the water bottle wasn't the water bottle. They would just freak out all along, you know. People thought I was healthy because I would use fruit as chasers and smoothies, you know. And one landlord, I mean, I lived with her on and off several hovels. We would go back and forth at these hovels. And we went out of town one time, and she was just like, oh, my God, Susan, you know, that's always been vodka. I had really, really good squeezy bottles. I would pick my purse for the day for how much water, you know, which water bottle to have and how much vodka I needed and her shoplifting. And I could pick out a purse I still can at Goodwill that can hold a lot of shit and you can't tell. It looks little. I mean, it's a gift. So so my liver goes into failure. And at this point, I really thought at this point that my life was going pretty good. We had avoided going to jail. In the middle of that, I did go to jail a couple times before my liver failed. And that was the best I'd slept. I remember the second time I went, because we were living in a dangerous situation with dangerous people, and people were going to jail, and things were, you know, gunshots. It was bad. And so I remember when I went to, plus I always had ex-boyfriends getting out of jail that were wanting to get me, and I got a new boyfriend. I mean, that was a theme. And so when I went to jail, I could sleep through the night because I wasn't worried. I'd been there before, you know. So I did 2 stints in jail because probation is not for me. And my liver fails and I go into the hospital. And, I mean, I'm telling them, they sent the ambulance and I'm like, fuck y'all, Trump is president. I know the date. Fuck y'all. But my mother-in-law, my former mother-in-law got involved and I knew that she was going to call the police and tell them I tried to commit suicide and get me locked up. I knew she'd do that because we had done it to her son and his wife. And so I was like, okay, I'll go in the morning. So I go to the hospital. I go to Northside. I get in ICU. I don't want to live. I'm there in and out of the hospital for like 4 weeks. And my boyfriend's still at home drinking. So that kid messed up his drinking a lot when, you know, we had a good deal going. My daughter wasn't speaking to me. My grandkids were out of my life for 4 years before my liver failed. But in my mind, we're doing good. We're controlling our drinking. I got a job. He's got a job. We go to work, you know. So then, and I don't want to live now because I know I can't go home and stay sober. And AA doesn't work for me because I can't get the God thing. And, you know, I have conditions. So that, you know, I come home and I'm just like broken. And I can't eat sodium, which I'm still pissed about, but I'm working on that. And I can't imagine life without drinking. So I get a big book. And also, all of my experience had been you go to treatment. You go to a halfway house. And so I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Nobody will, because you're dying of your, you know, liver failure. What are you going to do? So they won't take you, you know. Beachford won't take you. Nobody wants you. And so I was like, I'm going to die. I'm doomed. And because it was going to be very, very painful to drink myself to death, and I'd already experienced, you know, all the pain from that, I was decided that I would get myself better enough to get a job, you know, back to work so that I could get monies for pills so that I could commit suicide. And during this time, I just started reading my big book from beginning to end, and I wasn't getting really anything out of it. And I really looked at it like punishment because I deserved, you know, I'm the piece of shit that can't quit drinking even when it's going to kill me. And now I don't even have it. And it was so ingrained in me, y'all, that I would just, if I got upset on the phone, I'm reaching for the vodka bottle. I'm reaching for the chaser cup. I am an alcoholic, you know. I remember the Northside was sent me home with hospice, which I thought was a list of physical therapists. And I'm sitting on my bed like it's sinking in. I'm on 19 medications. So what I did, the medications, let's just real quick say, I go through and I pick 19 things, not even including the vitamin and the probiotic. I go to figure out which ones make you dizzy and which ones make you drowsy. You know, I'm not some are 2 a day, some are, and I'm trying to figure all that out. Some are with food, some all without food. Give me a break, you know, if I want some effect here. It turns out that it didn't say drowsy, it said dizzy. And so I was almost passing out because my blood pressure kept rocking because I was taking all the dizzy ones together. So I was in trouble. You know, I was in trouble. So Northside had sent me home to die, and we went back because I was in all this pain, and they gave me a shot of morphine, which is not even supposed to be, you know, which didn't help, and sent me home, and a friend got in touch with another friend who was a physician's assistant that I'd gone to high school with. And we went and told her the truth, and she got me into Emory with the specialist. And I remember going into his office, and not well, I don't remember much of it, but I remember him saying, you know, how long has it been since you had a drink? And I said, 14 days. 14 days. And he kept saying he was smelling it on me. I'm like, no, it has been 14 long days, but I know how long. And so he was still smelling the ammonia on me and everything, you know. And it took, there was another doctor while I was at Emory, and he said that for a week, every morning he came in, he couldn't believe I was still on the list, you know, to go talk to me. So at the end, the Emory doctor comes over and he sits down. The crash cart was pulled on me at one point, which I don't really remember. And I found that out as I was leaving. But the doctor, he pulls his little table over, and he's sitting looking at me, you know, eye to eye. And he said, if you drink within the next, he said, if you drink again, you're going to die. And he told me that if you get, you won't even get drunk, you're going to start getting sick. I didn't even believe that shit. I drank on antabuse. You know, I was like, whatever. He's just trying to make me not drink. But I kept telling everybody, but I've been in AA. I had 5 months. So I know, you know, I can go back to AA. And so I'm telling him, I won't drink. And he said, if you drink, he said that if you don't drink, you have 1 to 4 years to live. And so, you know, And, you know, my daughter's not speaking to me. My boyfriend is drinking. And now I can't work. And I, you know, I'm just going to be honest. I'm not going to talk about those things I'm not supposed to talk about. But I was in diapers and I was shitting myself for 4 months. I mean, just like it was, I was on a walker and I was having to try and make my own food and drink 8 glasses of water a day. And it was just too, it was a lot. So at 4 months, I was going to kill myself. I got my mother-in-law to get me. I said, I need meetings. The other thing is that all these people, even the people that know me in treatment all those years and in and out of AA, to them, I'd gone 4 months without a drink. They did not see that I needed, you know, outside help. So my former mother-in-law comes and gets me, and she takes me, brings me here to the 130 for 5 days, Monday through Friday. The main thing I remember is I got relief and that I wasn't suicidal anymore. And that was really, you know, I wasn't a lot going through. But so on Friday she picked me up and she's like, well, I know you're tired from going to all these meetings. So she wouldn't take me anymore. She was just, you know, so I'm like, oh, and I have no money and I have, you know, I'm just lost. So at 7 months and 1 day, I'm wanting one of those chips I never got before because I've only had a 90-day chip. And so I was like, I need to get to a meeting. I'm telling everybody I can talk to. I don't want to go to a meeting. So finally this friend of mine, who's in a, he's sober now, but he said, I'll take you to a meeting. So he takes me over to Biscayne for the 6 o'clock. And the door is locked at the front. So we're leaving. And so an old-timer there was standing outside because he's late frequently, and he says, hey, you can come in this door right here. Come on in. So we did. And so I don't remember what was said in that meeting. I remember it was the first meeting I ever shared in my life. And I remember saying to my buddy Drew, I'm coming back. Now, he's younger, and he's got a biker dude, much younger, like 20 years younger than me, and he's got long hair, and he just got out of prison. And so he was like, oh, you no, this meeting sucks. He's like, all these old folkies. He was like, I'll take you to Triangle on a Friday night, and we'll get a meeting in. And I'm like, I don't want to meet people. So we had different goals. So anyway, when I got, people came up to me, two of them are sitting here today, and came up to me immediately and said, oh, my God, here's my number. You know, keep coming back. Another girl that's here today, she called me that week. And she, what they said was, they said, on Fridays, the last Friday of the month, we have cake. And we celebrate everybody's birthdays, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, those were the words I remembered. And so that gave me the guts to go back because I had a face to look for, you know. But I do remember she called, and I was going, oh, my God, that AA lady is calling me. Oh, my God. But I just want to say that if you get a newcomer's number and they don't call you, it did help that she did just make that friendly call. And so then, you know, the way I remember it, so now I got 7 months. I got my little yellow six-month chip. And I walked into Biscayne when I had 7 months and 1 day. And then people realized pretty quickly that how sick I was, that I needed it. I mean, I look back on it, I didn't see this at the time, but life started getting better right away, even though it really still sucked at home, but it started getting better. I was feeling better. Now I got friends. I'm making friends. I had to call people every day to ask for a ride. And oh my God, I thought it was the worst thing that I'd ever been through in my entire life. And I would text people and they'd say, oh no, I'm not going today. And then I'd text somebody else and get to be 4 o'clock. And I always had, he's here too, my one emergency person I could call, which I think only happened maybe 3 or 4 times. But I have a calendar at home. I think it was for November that year. And I would put down who's giving me a ride. So I got to know who goes when, on what days. And I got, like, you know, Pete was always good for a Monday and a Thursday. And, you know, certain people, what days they go. And so I looked down and I had seen on this whole month, you know, a fellowship was growing up around me who would pick me up every day. I had $11 for emergencies for a cab. And that $11 stayed in my wallet like 4 months. I didn't need it. And, you know, because I was getting rides every day. And so, and also my mother-in-law, when she would take me, sometimes I was still in the beginning getting rides from people that weren't in AA, and she was used to bringing me when the meeting starts at 6 and the meeting's over at 7 and pick me up at 7:01. And my friend Emily, I remember in the summer, so I get in the car with my friend Emily, who's not in the program and not familiar with AA, but she has been with me through all of the alcoholism, and she's giving me rides, and I'd say, well, this old-timer, he was talking. I said, he sits there and he looks like he has won the lottery and that Oprah's about to walk in and give us all a car. And he knows it, but he can't tell us. And he just sits back smiling. And he's not here tonight, but I'm talking about Bill Hunter, if you know him. And then people just shared. I mean, I don't even know. I was crazy. I couldn't make sentences. I got a sponsor. That I remember the day that I had sponsors before, but they were people that were doing it their own way, in their new age way, and I've got a new spin. One lady, she took me back so many times, and we didn't even understand step 4. It's hilarious when I look back on it now. But so in the end, I finally got us. I'm like, I got to get a sponsor. I kept going to the meetings and then not asking anybody, and scared to death. And so, the end of a meeting, I was like, I cannot leave this parking lot and without asking somebody. So I'm asking people who raised their hand, and somebody parks over to this lady in a car, and I walk over there. I remember I just couldn't move. I couldn't move. I've been in the back of an ambulance, y'all, in labor, in traffic at 5 o'clock, 9 o'clock traffic, and going to Gwinnett County, about to have a baby, and going headed for an emergency C-section. And I've not been afraid as I was when I was fucking having to walk to that car. And all I could see was my feet. It was like, and I was just like, just walk. So I went over there. She said, sure. It was a Friday. She said, call me this weekend. So I called her Sunday night. And, but I remember her saying, your life is going to be amazing. And I thought she was a Pollyanna crazy. Oh, she's one of them. Do you believe in God? I'd never really admitted to people that I didn't believe in God. So I said, I was like, I knew I needed to be honest. And so I told her the truth, and I didn't. And so then I'm trying to think how. So that's how. So step one, this is the way I figured out step one. I didn't figure it out all those years that I was in and out. And someone was sharing in a meeting one day. At 4 months, when I had gotten suicidal, that's when I was going to drink. And that's when I knew the real, the true bottom, the end of myself, where I'm going to drink and I know it's going to kill me. And I can't not drink. I can't. And I cried on my deck like I'd never cried before, because I was just like, my daughter here, her father's dying, killing himself, drinking mouthwash. He just died in July. And so I, you know, at least, oh my God, I can try. And that's when I went to those meetings for that week. So then, but my plan was still, that AA was not going to work for me. And so I, a fellowship to school. My story should be called How It Works. So people kept sharing about being open-minded. People kept sharing about the Appendix 2 in the back of the book and how you can have a psychic change necessary to become sober without having a white light God experience, you know, and that, and I remember I highlighted that thing, and I told my boyfriend, I put on the grocery list, we need new highlighters, I want different colors on this thing, and I printed it out, it gave me hope, that was when the hope started, so that's when step two started, because, and I remember being in the car with someone who's here, and she would say, well, this will happen, and you can do this, and I'm thinking, God, she is such a Pollyanna, because she doesn't understand that I'm an alcoholic. And I can't do all the things he's done, and that's not going to work and happen for me, because I'm a real piece of shit. And so then I remember one day I came home, and I remember shutting the door and thinking, man, what if they were right? Like, what if I lived the whole 4 years, and, you know, and it wasn't so bad, and, it, you know? And that was the beginning of hope, not no. So I think that it's important to mention that, that we need to take responsibility. I needed to take responsibility for my own sobriety. And I was in my first sponsor relationship was a difficult one. And they had, had their own issues. So I didn't take, I had little red flags, but I didn't trust anybody. And I was really afraid to trust anybody and say, this is what's happening. And I don't think this, and there was no way I was ever telling her my fourth step ever. And so, but I was scared, and so people gave me advice to, find another sponsor first. And so the scariest thing I ever did was ask the second person to be my sponsor. And she said yes. And so she's still my sponsor. And she, and all of a sudden I started sleeping through the night, y'all. She made it so much easier because the other person had me very, you gotta do this, and we talked 3 times a day, and she was sending me all these emails for self-help things, and you gotta do your 4 step, and I was just, losing my mind. So, so I got a new sponsor. Things got much easier. She said, stop working on this 4 step now, and which just, and I slept through the night for the first time in probably since I've been in jail. I mean, literally. And I was like, oh, my God. And so she tricked me into doing a lot of the 4-step work. Now, the other thing is I told her, all I need is somebody just to show me how to work the steps. And I won't be any trouble, and I'll do everything you ask. So some of those things came true, and some of them didn't. I was a mess, and I was high maintenance. And, but I had told her I would do whatever you asked. So I did. And that gave me also some self-esteem because I had some self-worth because I'm doing what I say I'm going to do. I remember my friend Emily picked me up one day and I get in the car and I said, we're supposed to do esteemable things. And she was like, what the hell does that mean? You know? And I said, well, so I started like turning off all the lights before I go to a meeting. That was my first esteemable thing. And I was like, I was so broken, y'all, and my brain was fried. And I mean, when I first came, I had like probably 2 months, but I couldn't read the analog clock. Like my brain couldn't figure out what time it was. I had to go to find the digital clock. And it was bad, you know. And so, but I started getting this little hope, this little, and so, and then we took this 3rd step prayer, and then I started writing some letters, and just living sober, just trying to get into the groove of, what the deal is. And so I got a car in February. So now I got a year and a half. I got a car and I can go to any meeting I want and screw all of you. I do not have to ask you for a ride. Oh, and I can give people rides and, I got power, And the pandemic hit. So now I can't go anywhere. And, So that was really, really scary because when you think about not just the fact that I had a third of a liver and so I was high risk, but also the fact that meeting makers make it. And I was, and that I'd never been a meeting maker. And I, my sponsor, I always called her. And so my phone rings and I'm like, and I had all the TVs on. I remember this. So I had all the TVs on different channels because I need to know what's going on. And, and I'm just panicked in my hallway, and the phone rings, and I'm like, who could that be? And it's her, and I'm like, oh. And so I pick, at that point, because we thought she was going to be working, she ended up working from home. But so she answered the phone, And I said, I think we had not discussed any medical stuff. She's never, ever told me what I should do about my medical stuff. Go what your doctor says. She never told me whether I should go to meetings or not go to meetings, wear a mask, don't wear a mask. That she kept separate. But I said, I think I need to stop going to meetings. And she said, I do too. Well, there was a relief there. And then she said, we. And I remember just, I heard that we loud. And she said, people are going to stay sober in this pandemic. And we are going to figure out how they do it. Now, my sponsor stands on some big shoulders. And so, I mean, every probably half an hour, there's a ding on my computer where she's sending me a new Zoom meeting. And she's getting in touch with these women that helped her get sober. And how are they going to do it? And so I figured out Zoom. And so looking back now, I realized that my higher power used the pandemic for my good as far as, so I started going to 3 meetings a day. I started going to, well, in the beginning, a lot of people, sometimes 4. There was a time I was going to 5 and I was told to cut back. I admitted it in a meeting, and after the meeting, she's like, no, come here a minute. Maybe we're avoiding some things. But I went to NAVA meetings because I wanted to meet people in Atlanta. And so I loved Monday mornings because I'd get up and I'd do the 7:30 big book study, then the 8 o'clock. And Sunday, my boyfriend's still drinking, so Sundays are rough at my house, you know. Monday morning, I'm like, got my big book study, then I'm doing my next one, and then we got the stories, and, you know, and then so, and all the step studies, and it was amazing. And I went through the step, I remember I went through the 12 and 12 where I had not worked. 5 and 6 and 7 yet. And then the next year I'm going through and I've worked them, and they mean so much different to read that 12 and 12 when you've done it. And so many people in here are in my big book, you just don't know. So then I use that to my advantage. I remember that's when I learned how to live one day at a time. And my sponsor and I kept very close. And she's like, we're going to talk 3 times a day. And that's when we thought it was going to be 3 weeks. She had no idea. And also, in the middle of that, while I'm freaking out, though, she was, I didn't even think about it till later. She had a wedding coming up. I mean, like a big wedding. And she was having to figure out whether to cancel it, what to do about it. Never said a word to me. She was just there for me. And she picked up the phone when I called, you know. And so we stayed sober, and I got to a fellowship grew up around me, and I Al-Anon is also part of my story that it's been a huge resource for me, huge to help me focus on myself instead of the drinking person I'm living with, and I did my 5th step. Okay, so we did it at Biscayne. And at this point, I do believe in a higher power. I've had so many coincidences, there's no way. So now I have a morning practice. I was working, a little, my version, I guess, of 10 every night. You know, I was reading that page 86 every night, and I was reading page 87 in the morning. I figured all that out real quick because during the beginning of the pandemic, I was looking for the people that had peace on their faces. You know, in the meeting. So there were people that were, and there were people that, so it, like, the, I went to 3 meetings in a row. It was 2 one day and the next morning, and the all 3 of them, the topic was not resting on our laurels. And, you know, so all these people that had a lot of time that were now facing the same thing I'm facing, they're like, take a shower, get up, make something to eat, turn off the TV. These, you know, and I did, and it was hard. That turning off the TV was hard, but I don't watch the news now because of it. I mean, so I did my 5th step, finally. I was ready. Every scrap of paper, every bad thing I could ever remember. And so I thought it was going to take weeks. And we get in there, and she's like, no, we're going to finish this today. And we did, and then we burned it. And that was the most, freeing thing. So, really, the step 5, because I'd avoided it all my life, I was never telling anybody everything, after that, the effect was that it made my past. And I remember getting in, when I first got my car, realizing, oh my God, I'm not alone in the car. There's a higher power here with me. They're not alone in their car. It was a weird feeling. It was such an uncommon thing, or so uncomfortable for me. And then, So we did the fifth step, and so then we did six and seven. And I just recently found my list of character defects, and I've forgotten half of them. And so that we had written down. Now I've been working on the good ones, but it was like, oh, wow, oh, we were so insightful. And so then because we took our time on four and five, or four, I thought that it was going to be the same for eight and nine. So we do eight, and we go over, like, how I'm going to make amends. So she says, tomorrow, I want you. I'm like, tomorrow? No, what is this faux trap? No, now I got to do what she says. So the next day I went to CVS because I owed them a big apology, and the police had been involved, and I really owed them. And I was still having to get my medicine from them, and the woman was so sweet. And she was like, we know you're sick. And, you know, so I then the next day on Tuesday, I went to my mother's grave and I made amends. And it was the most incredible thing I've ever done and the most freeing thing I've ever done. And so my father's amends, I had written a letter and I said, he's passed. And I said it to when he died, we were estranged. So I had said it to my sponsor. But then when I was going out to visit my daughter in Kansas, I happened to pass the city, the little town, Blackwell, Oklahoma, where he was born, which is just, and so I pulled over, and I went to the bathroom in the ice cream place, and I came back out, and I made amends to my dad, just sitting there at the thing. So I went out to visit my daughter. We started healing big time. It turns out the secret is just listening and just shut up, you know, Susan, and letting her get off the phone first. What? And now I'm there for her, and she's gone through a really, really rough year and a half. She's coming out of it now, but really, really bad, like facing homelessness and all this stuff. And she's able to call me, and I was able to be there for her. And she even posted on Facebook that she appreciated me, y'all. And I mean, that was, I'd arrived. So, because she won't even tell me she loves me. She's angry, you know. She had a bad childhood. So, then, and the other thing I wanted to throw in there is there was a guy that I'd done all the stuff with. We went to the same high school, and then we worked at Ken's Tavern together. And you know, he knew me when things were bad, and I knew him when. But everybody had known he'd gotten sober. And so, and I would run into him every once in a while, like at the thrift store, and hold my breath and hug him, like, because I'm smelling, and, you know. But I got in touch with him, and he gave me, so he was like, yeah, Susan, where do you live? I'll come get you, and he started taking me to meetings. And when he believed, because this is someone who knew me when, and had done it all too, and now he's got 15 years, he still drove like an idiot, but we're in the car, I'm like, oh. But he was like, you can do this. And he was telling me how, you know, how much it had changed his life, and it carried a lot of depth and a lot of weight, because I believed him. You know, I was like, and he thinks I'm deserving, you know. The thing about, you know, I still have some amends to make to my brother, but he doesn't live here, and we're kind of estranged. But otherwise, you know, I can't even describe. It changed who I am, working the steps, taking the steps. It changed who I am. I now have, you know, it sounds corny, but I have a design for living. I lost my best friend of 51 years to this disease October 11th. She had married my ex-husband, and they were married for 25 years, but we've been friends since second grade, and they were drinking mouthwash. And it's the worst death I have ever seen, the longest, you know, and it sucked. I didn't even know how hard it was going to be, but I knew what to do. And I thought about drinking for just a brief second, and I was like, oh, my God. And so I got on the phone, and I got to extra meetings. You know, when anything bad happens, I go to lots of extra meetings. So, you know, those are my tools. And I call people. I hated calling people and asking for help. I hated it. But once I've done it, and now that I'm in the other side, I love it when people call me and want help, you know. And I think that, I don't know, now I got 5 minutes left, so I guess I got 5 years now. My life has, I lived with fear all my life, and I'm not afraid anymore. And if I do get afraid, I got a little prayer I can say, and I can call somebody, and I can get to a meeting. The day I had some of my biggest secrets have to do with giving a child up for adoption. And the day before I gave my fifth step, No, it was the 2 days before. It was a Friday, and it was at the 5:45 on Zoom, and four people tell my darkest secret during this meeting. And I remember I remember thinking, God is in my room right now. God is here telling me, tell it all, get it out. And it's okay. I'm not a worthless person because I made these decisions out of alcohol, you know. So I will say that I was very, very good. I drank for 38 years. I was very good at protecting my drinking and to protecting my lifestyle that I could continue to drink. And I just can't believe my life is beyond my wildest dreams, and I'm never going to be rich. Well, I never know, and maybe I don't want to say never, but I'm not. You know, I'm not. I'm happy and content with the things I have. I got my little car. I love going to meetings. I never thought that. I love the literature. I love all the people, and I've got two sponsees, and I don't know what else to say. The program works. The program really does work, and you don't have to believe in God. You don't even have to believe that it works. You don't have to. You just have to follow, just get a sponsor and do what they say. And if they're crazy, then people will tell you. And so anyway, thank you.
Wow. All I can say is that was fantastic. And the one thing that you said that really like sent chills was when you said that you kept calling people to take you to meetings, and then you looked at your calendar and you realized that you were building like your whole little like family. That I was like tears, because that is how it works. That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
I used to hate my pain. Avoid the feelings like a winter rain. I'd run away, hiding the hurt with a drink or an angry word. Until the day I could not deny the healing calling from deep inside. It was a love that was here to mend. My broken heart could be my friend. On the other side, I will rise above our mountains, here to climb. As I grow, I stumble and I fall, but I am grateful for it all. On the other side, there is peace beneath the pain. A tender tear that I can't explain, washing away the fearful wounds, bearing a light for my life to bloom. On the other side, I will rise above a mountain. I must climb. As I grow, I stumble and I fall, I am grateful for it all. On the other side, on the other side, I live my dreams, finding joy, free. I grow, I stumble, and I fall. grateful.